How are you guys? It's good to see you all. And just so appreciated last weekend and getting to spend Easter together. And Easter is just this wonderful celebratory moment as we focus on the resurrection and seek to understand this miracle that's right at the center of why we're meeting here today. And I don't know if you know this, but Easter is not meant to be just a day. It's a season of feasting that lasts for 50 days. Did you know that? So, yeah. So if you need permission to feast, let's feast, right? This is a 50-day period where we celebrate Easter. But today in particular is like a second Easter, especially if you're Orthodox. Did you know this? That the Orthodox Easter actually is today. And so I thought in celebration of that fact, my wife being Greek, what we say instead of Christ is risen, he is risen indeed is, do we have a slide? Christos Aneste, and you say Alados Aneste, right? So we want to practice that. Christos Aneste. Yeah, not bad. Y'all learned a little Greek today, so congratulations. Well done. Easter, this idea of remembrance, you know, I think that so often is what we need more than anything. That we're often drawn to new ideas. We're drawn to things that are sort of bleeding edge. When often what we need, what often we long for is this sort of restorative sense of like reclaiming what we already know to be true. That we have a tendency, I think, in our lives to drift a little bit. And so Easter is this way of coming back to that center. It has this sort of reforming nature to us. It refines us. It brings us back to the core. And I was sitting with Shirley in this week, and she said to me, is Shirley here? Okay. She says, did you know, there she is. She says, do you know that every year on Easter, you always talk about Thomas? And I was like, oh shoot, you're right. It's sort of my go-to at Easter. And I was thinking about that. What is it about Thomas? And part of it, I think, is that John is my favorite gospel. And I love how John writes very different than the other gospels, an account about Jesus that focuses on signs. Did you know that? That John is really a sequence of miracles, but each one of these miracles points to something significant, whatever it is, water into wine, right? He's the only one that tells that, but he tells it as a sign, meaning to understand this points us to Christ. If he heals a blind person, this is showing us something about Jesus that should lead us to a conclusion which Thomas ends up giving for us. That some would say this moment of Thomas's like reconversion is John's whole point of his gospel. And Thomas is this cynic, right? He's cautious. He's a skeptic. And here he is in this renewed moment of hope for the disciples saying, I will never believe, like not again. What would it take, Thomas? I'd have to like stick my fingers into the wounds, right? It's kind of a graphic picture that he's drawing, which, you know, you could say he's not like creating some tests. Like, well, if Jesus came and showed me his wounds, then I'd believe. He's going, really, I'll never believe. I'll never believe. And this picture of Jesus coming in to the skeptic, which, if I'm honest, maybe I identify with a little bit. That the questioner, the cautious one, and how Jesus holds his hands out and shows us that he's just not afraid of our questions. And as he holds out his hands, Thomas responds with maybe the center point of John's gospel, my Lord and my God. To understand all of this, to understand what this means, it's not just some revelation about reality, but something that Thomas then brings his life and his heart into submission to. That this isn't just a profound, charismatic man. This is God standing there in his midst. John's telling us, don't miss it. And then Jesus goes on and says one extra little bit there. He says, Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And that statement, I think in some ways I'm encouraged by that, because I think that's an added blessing for people like you and me. People who have not seen and still believe, right? And see, I think sometimes we look at that and mistakenly think, oh, Jesus is praising a sort of blind leap of faith. You don't see, but you just believe anyways. That's not the case. Jesus is talking about really what is at the essence of faith. To believe and trust in what is true, even when we can't put our hands into the wounds. To look carefully at reality and see the deeper truth versus just getting lost in the appearance of things. Does that make sense? It talks in Hebrews. The author of Hebrews says that faith is being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you don't see. And I like how Dallas Willard puts it like this. He says, faith is opposed to sight, but not to knowledge. That we are pursuing knowledge. It's knowledge that pushes us into faith, right? But oftentimes it goes against the appearances of things. It's the deeper mystery that we notice and see. I think this is maybe why I like talking about science from the pulpit. Because I think science functions this way these days, doesn't it? That we learn about these truths about reality itself and go, well, it certainly doesn't match the appearances. This looks solid, but it isn't. This is mostly space. And this is composed of these subatomic particles that some of which are becoming part of me as I speak, and other parts of me are becoming part of this. Did you know that? Like, what in the world? And we're like, no, right? That's just solid. And you're like, I don't know why my hand doesn't just go right through this. It should, but it doesn't, right? And science is kind of like, ah. And I think the permission that it gives us, so much of these things that we're learning, we take on faith. And likewise, this is the kind of thing that we practice as we think about our spirituality. Not some sort of abstract idea, but reality itself. And something that doesn't always match the appearances. And so we practice it. We exercise it. There's a blessing for believing. I have a good friend who this a few months ago ended up going through a job. Well, he ended up getting laid off. And this is a friend in ministry. And in talking to my friend, he was kind of going, what if I'm doomed? And I'm thinking, you're a pastor. You know the answer to this, right? Like, God will provide. But sometimes we get rattled like that and are like, oh no, don't we? We know the answer, but the belief sometimes wavers. And had just a sweet conversation with him this week because I kind of teased him about that. Like, we do know that God is up to something, right? We can trust in this fact. And he's like, I know. And then sure enough, he called me this week and said, you're never going to believe this opportunity out of nowhere, right? And then he stopped me. He's like, you were right. But it's easy to say that to somebody else in their circumstance, isn't it? But oftentimes for us, this exercise of belief, we know this to be true, and yet we drift. We have to reorient our lives back to this truth that holds us kind of in check. There's a wonderful quote by C.S. Lewis where he says this. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. I love that quote because I think this is the truth that once you see this thing, you realize it like changes the way we see everything. That to understand this reality leads us into deeper reality, deeper truth. It's beckoning us further and further into the mysteries of how deep reality goes. And Lewis, I think one of the reasons I'm really drawn to him is that, first off, his testimony is so different than my own. That I was learning scripture verses before I even became a Christian. If you can imagine, I learned the 23rd Psalm before I made a decision to invite Jesus into my heart, and I did that at age 4. So Christianity is like my lens. It's my worldview from the very beginning. And this wasn't the case with Lewis. He was this defiant atheist. He was somebody who had set himself in opposition to this truth. And as he comes to faith, he would describe it as kicking and screaming. And yet something deep in him compelled him, maybe like Thomas, that this deeper hunger to know truth. And it's helpful for me to read somebody like that and to just see his process, because it's not like mine. My journey has been taking what I was taught and deciding, is this the way I believe? But for him, you see this whole arc going from disbelief to belief. And the truth is that for each one of us, those are different things, the step to faith in God versus the step to Christianity. That those are not one and the same. I think of this beautiful quote from Einstein where he says, "We're in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of the human mind, even the greatest and most cultured, toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but only dimly understand these laws. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that sways the constellations." Now, what Einstein's saying there is that true, in one sense, absolutely. When we look at the vastness of the cosmos and how little we truly understand and think that we're trying here to understand the complexities of God. But one of the things that I think we celebrate as we meet is the way these things have been revealed and continue to be revealed to us today. That as we come here and think about theology, as we come here and talk about religion, what we're really talking about is the greatest complexities, the thing behind the thing. Not just the creation, but the creator. As we study scripture, as we look around us and decipher what is this deeper truth, we're thinking about the things that matter most. It's the privilege of what we get to do here. And I've been thinking about this kind of going forward. We finished a series on wisdom right before this, and then we've talked now about the resurrection. But kind of in the spirit of Lewis, I thought it might be fun for us to talk about what he called mere Christianity. It was kind of an exercise that he did to get at the very basic elements, these truths, these simple yet deep truths that lead us further in. I thought this would be a fun practice because not only are we reoriented to the resurrection, but we need to spend time unpacking all that it entails. We do this because we're invited to it. We do this also because we're responsible to it. There's a verse in Romans 1 where Paul says this. What can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And that warning there, that not only is truth here and available for us, but we're accountable to know it, to understand it. to go further. Obviously, none of us are going to reach this comprehensive level of knowledge of God, and yet what we are able to see and perceive and pursue, we're expected to. It's part of why we're here, to seek to know truth and to seek to know God. And I love it how God is showing himself. He's showing himself all around, that everything we look at, everything we can point to, is beckoning us to come further in. We look at the design in nature. We look at the beauty that moves our hearts. I mean, if you've gone hiking recently, and like, you just see the mustard exploding, right? It's just so beautiful. All of these things should lead us further into an understanding of who God is. It defines the way we live, why we live, the purposes and intentions of our own hearts. And Lewis, when he put together Mere Christianity, he did it at a time where Britain was in chaos. It was in the middle of World War II, and people were scared. And the guy who was in charge of like the programming for the BBC went and read one of his books. It was called The Problem of Pain. And he read it, and he wrote a letter to Lewis, and he said, "Would you come on and just give us like the layman's view? Why are you a Christian?" And Lewis was like, "Well, okay." You know, he kind of thought about it, and then he thought, he had asked a few different, you know, given him a few different ideas, but that one resonated with Lewis. The layman's view, but also, what is the thing that sort of unites Christians? What is the mere Christianity? He came up with this term, and it's in the introduction to his book, the HCF, which, I mean, must have been like commonly used back then in mathematics to refer to the highest common factor. What's the highest common factor? What's the thing? You have all these different views. Here's an Anglican over here, and here's a Presbyterian over here. Here's a Catholic over here. What's the thing that they'd all sign off on? Yeah. And so he took that and he brought that into the center of this thing. He put together this radio show that ended up going 4 seasons long. All the tapes of it have been destroyed except for one, and you can go look it up on YouTube and you can hear him speak. They say at that time, his voice was second, like well known only second to Winston Churchill. That millions would tune in to listen as he spoke those words. There's a story that said that they would play it in pubs and people would be like, "Shut up!" Right? Like, it's Lewis. Like, we gotta listen to this guy. He brought in this message that cut right to the heart. And as I think about this, I think in some ways we're in a sort of similar time period where we look around at the world and we're anxious. We're afraid of the things that we see happening globally. We're afraid of things that we see happening within our own country. Afraid of the way it affects us, our future, all of these things. And it's amazing how this message created at that time such stability. But it also cut to their heart. I think this is what Lewis is so good at doing, is deciphering down, where's the root of all this? What is the thing that is wrong? And the thing, the place where he decided to begin, think about this. If you were going to just start from scratch, where would you start if you were going to diagnose the problem? Lewis decided to start with quarrels, with arguments. And Europe, in England in this time, is kind of in this, what people would call, it was becoming more and more post-Christian. America, I think, finds itself in a very similar sort of place. And a post-Christian is not anti-Christian. It's just like, yeah, we tried that and it didn't work. Right? It's sort of the mindset there. And so something takes its place. And in Europe at that time, I think what he noticed is that everybody had just sort of seen truth as their own truth, their own way of thinking. That I was, in the end, the highest authority. Does that sound familiar? And when you think about quarreling, right, that is like a starting place. All you got to do is turn on the news and you're like, gosh, no kidding, right? Everybody quarreling. Everybody fighting. Everybody just stating the way it is. and disregard for those that oppose, right? You just see this over and over again, the texture of it. It's certain, it's defiant, it claims this kind of authority for ourselves. All you got to do is like look at the comments beneath anything on YouTube, and you see this like self-righteousness that comes pouring out. And Lewis kind of went, interesting, why is that the case? Why do we feel this need to state things in such a way? Why do we state it in such opposition? And what are we appealing to? Because people aren't just going, you know, in my opinion, right? They're not. You know, in my humble opinion, they're like, no, this is the way it is. And he says, you know, without knowing it, people are appealing to a higher standard. And they think it's their own, but they're wrong. Right? They're going, what gives me the right to say such a thing? Well, justice is on my side. Right? Freedom is on my side. Some value is on my side. We should approach life this way because justice. And Lewis is saying, as if we sort of all kind of know justice. As if we all understand freedom. As if we all get what virtue is or compassion or love and see the value of those things, that becomes a sort of universal appeal. Are you guys following me? Like, where the heck does that come from? Why do people feel so justified? They state it as if it's their own, but then pull in some sort of outside ruler and claim that it shows that their line is straight. Lewis goes, that's the first thing I want to start with there. And the second is this, that nobody keeps even their own code. We appeal to it, we claim it as our own, and then we break it. Every single person is a hypocrite. And he goes, I think I'm going to start there. I mean, amazing that this thing took off, right? Except that we all sort of sit there and nod and go, he's not wrong. Lewis thought, before we even get into talking about Jesus, we first need a little dose of guilt. And guilt is a word that probably, like, sets us back a little bit. We don't like guilt, but the truth is that guilt is our friend. Guilt comes in and convicts, shows us where we're out of alignment. And I think what really Lewis is getting at is not just guilt, but we need some humility. That if there's going to be a starting point to this discussion, we need to understand that truth is greater than us. This fact that Paul is getting at in Romans, that we're accountable to something greater than that. This greater authority, this thing that brings conviction. We can pretend for a while that it's not there, right? But it has this way of showing up in our lives. I think about this every time I'm paying my taxes. Does anybody have a phobia of paying taxes, by the way? It's a real thing, right? There's a name, we were talking about this in our elder board. Forosophobia. Is the name of it. Phoros is the Greek word for tax. So if you kind of sweat and perspire as you're doing your taxes, that's a little bit of phorosophobia. But I had this moment that happened where we had switched to an HSA for our health insurance. And so, you know, I was doing my own taxes and just kind of gave it my best shot and submitted it and got a letter from the IRS. Have you ever gotten a letter from the IRS? It's terrifying. It's terrifying, right? Authority comes in and is like, hey, right? And I spent like the next few months unwinding and redocumenting, going through all the rules and figuring it out. And see, Lewis is saying that this reality, we all have this tendency to just sort of see ourselves in light of like the best version of ourselves until we get a letter from the IRS. That reality has this way of sneaking in and showing us, oh, wait a second, there's a right way to do this. It's their way. And my responsibility is to conform to this code and this standard. And that story ended up turning out all right. But as Lewis is talking about this, he's making this appeal to people going, if that's the truth and you're accountable, wouldn't you like to know that? Wouldn't you like to know that ahead of time? That maybe that would affect the way you fill out your taxes. That would affect the way you live your life. That not only this thing that we appeal to, this moral standard, not only is it real, but it's on us to conform our life to this truth. That the things that offend us in this world offend us morally because they're wrong. Not just because we don't like them, but because they violate some deep standard. That there's such a thing as good and such a thing as evil in this world. And that this natural law that we're avoiding is actually this thing that explains so much about why we respond the way we do to evil. It's a good ringtone. There's an episode of Band of Brothers, and I've talked about this before, but I like it, where this story that takes place with the 101st Airborne in World War II. But there's an episode in there called Why We Fight. And it starts with these soldiers experiencing this sort of disillusionment. That they're in this place and they're realizing, why am I even here? What are we doing? I'm freezing cold, right? And they have that moment where they hear the German soldiers singing on Christmas Eve. And this sense of like, this is just humanity against humanity. What are we doing here? But in this, they finally are invading into Germany and they come across the first concentration camp. And there's this moment, right, where they're like, what is going on here? They assume this must be some kind of prison, that these people must be guilty of something. And they start asking these people, why are you in here? Who are you guys? And they're like, well, professors and artists and intellectuals. And they're like, what is going on? And finally they understand, oh, these are Jews that have been imprisoned here. And you could see this, like, their minds trying to wrap their heads around this. They're looking at something just evil and begin, like, wondering how is anybody capable of these kind of things? And the truth is, when we live in this kind of hypocrisy, that it has consequence. The further we get away from that, sort of the uglier we become. That we might be able to just sort of ignore this truth on a very basic level, but this stuff, when it builds over time, builds into things that are really, really dark and create so much harm. That we're asked to pay attention to the standard because in the end it becomes this seed that leads us to some really terrible places. And on the surface it starts as something very small. We see that thing on the surface every time we go to the stop sign at Glenary and Thalia. Have you, right? Who's with me? You want to see like the worst in humanity. It's at that intersection, right? Where you get there and you're like, psh, it's my turn. I'm just going, right? Like, I don't even care. And like people get so impatient, like two cars go on the stop sign and you're like, just wait till summer, right? It just gets ugly. Or this little merge out here coming out of the canyon where you're like, just every other car go. No, this guy's going to go around, right? This sort of self-entitled thing over time leads us into some of the deepest abuses that we see in life. And Lewis is, I think, so bravely in this first episode that he gave on the BBC, he's saying the atrocity that we see around us, it boils down to this thing that, as it turns out, is in each one of us. That where this all begins is not out there, it's in here. And this is why he's saying guilt is important, right? Because if we don't understand that, then all we do is we blame and we point, we identify them as the problem. And nothing changes. It's like taking a weed whacker and cutting weeds, right? And you're like, what good does that do? You have to get to the root of this thing. in this place of pride, this self-preference, this justification of all my actions as if I'm righteous and I'm right. This is an invitation to us to make corrections where they matter, but then to like begin living into what ultimately is going to bring the deep meaning and value to life. Not only is it correcting wrong behavior, but it's inviting us into something greater. And I remember this one day, I was driving actually out the canyon. And as I was driving, I was passing by and just sort of glanced over to the side and thought I saw feet sticking out by this car that was parked there. And I was like, that's interesting. And I thought, I'm super busy, so I'm just going to keep going. And I have no idea what that was. No, just kidding. I like, as I was driving, all of a sudden was like, come on, Jeff. And I swung around and went back there. And as I came up, sure enough, there was somebody who had fallen right by his car. And I got out of my car and went running to him, like helped him sit up. He was like a little bit incoherent, called an ambulance and just sort of sat with him. And as they came, they were able to get him in the car and, or the ambulance and take him off. But I remember thinking, I'm so glad I stopped, right? I was late to my appointment, but clearly that was the right thing to do. And this is what, again, as we're thinking about this idea of this law, we're thinking about this way that we're called to live. One of the things we notice is that we break our own rule. But the other thing that we notice, I think, when we pay attention, is that we're called to this like inner voice that's beckoning us to something larger. That's saying, even though we're stuck in this self-preservation, that we're called to be courageous. We're called to be compassionate. We're called to be generous. And so more than just guilt and noticing where we're wrong, there's a deeper sort of stirring in our hearts. The beauty of this shows us where we're out of alignment, but it invites us into a richer, larger story. And the guilt that Lewis is talking about, I think Brené Brown, she put it recently in a really good light. She says, guilt tells us when we've done something wrong. Shame tells us that we are something wrong. And this is truth that's not meant to shame us, to point to us and say, you're a bad person, but instead to point us where our life needs to come back corrected to truth. In submission to that greater truth. That there is a work that is going on that each one of us are invited to. And I love how in Romans Paul's saying, God comes and shows us this. We're told it's his kindness that leads us to repentance. And the cross just like sits there looming over all of this to me. That at Easter we are forced to look at our own brokenness, to see where we've sinned, where we're guilty, not in a way that's shaming, but in a way that's inviting. This is where our life has become out of whack. But it also speaks with this deep calling. Jesus is saying that he's begun this good work in us and that he will be faithful to complete it. In Romans 5, 6 through 8, Paul puts it like this. For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person. Though perhaps for a good person, one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That God sees us in our weakness, in our brokenness, sees us in our guilt, in our blemish, and his heart responds in love for that. And God comes along in kindness to us in that place. He reminds us that we're responsible, that our lives have weight, that there's an accountability for all of this and how we live. But there's so much more than that. As Thomas sees the reality of what Jesus has done, his heart is moved with surrender. My Lord and my God. And that's what this truth does. That's what this kindness does. It leads us to repentance. But repentance, Marcia said this morning, has this beautiful fragrance to it. It disarms us. It causes us to not just go down to our knees, but to open ourselves up to receive. That as we see our own helplessness to change, we see a God who has gone so far out of his way to set things right. And I love the simple beauty of that statement. God shows his love for us, and while we were still sinners, Christ died. I think we can sit with that. We will sit with that for the rest of our lives. This is the truth we come back to at Easter to remember. It's the truth that we let continue to digest and become part of who we are. This is right at the heart and at the essence of what Christianity is all about. And my prayer is that we will see that truth as a church with greater and greater clarity. And that kindness as we receive it will respond with kindness towards others. The gentleness in which we receive that truth, we will respond with gentleness towards others. Even when they cut in front of us over here, that we will respond with grace. That we'll see more and more the simple depth and beauty of the knowledge of God all around us. We'll be drawn deeper into the mysteries of that reality and who God is. And that we would believe more and more with the eyes of our heart, that deeper trust in God. I have some questions for you as we kind of draw this to a close here. And these are just opportunities to go deeper in your own heart as you're reflecting. And the first one, how do I behave in times of disagreement with others? And we've been talking about this, just going through wisdom, but I think it fits very well with what we're talking about today. Am I open to listening? Do I lose sight of their heart and just see the issue? I think so often when we fight, we fail to see that it's all about us and our ego and being right. How do we really see the heart of others? Number two, what in my life am I justifying that I know I shouldn't be doing? Sorry. Nobody likes that question, right? But how am I holding that truth at bay? Is there something I'm not doing that I know I should? What is the excuse I'm making for myself? What is the consequence? Those little points of dishonesty in our hearts build over time. How do we let that truth and that conviction, that knowledge, correct us? And lastly, what would it take to stay in that place of humility before God and others? What if we began each day with the realization that God died first for me in my weakness? What if we could first receive this kindness from God and then extend this kindness to those we might otherwise disagree with? How do we stay in that place? That Easter is not just a once a year recalibration, but a daily recalibration. Bringing ourselves back to that truth. The kindness of God loves us while we are still sinners. Would you stand with me? And we are going to have people down front to pray if you would like to pray. Anything in this message that you feel like stirs, anything else that's going on in your hearts, maybe you've got something you want to celebrate and to pray with. But we would love to pray with you. We're going to ask that you would just exit out the back and we'll kind of keep this space down here in front for prayer. thank you for being here. If you're new, welcome. It's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us this morning. Let me leave you with a blessing as we go. May God bless you and keep you. May God make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. And may God lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. God bless you.